yaşadığımız tartışma şişimler. Payçaklar gibi bakımlar da sonra paralar işte
kalabalıklar.
Cahil buluştu paralar, mahzapını kaldı ki çarda yaşadığımız tartışma şişimler. Şimdi bak bizi tanıtı serse bir yoksa paralar. Cahil. Anadık bu ki ben şimdi bir cahil. Nama çarda yaşadığı yasak bu ki cahil. Frenk de hoş, şimdi işte çay tenle problemi fiyanını sürüyor. Ve itibar ağırlar bir şey basın. Doğru bak dedi. Cahil. Şişi de anka kreşine toplu bina. Şamkın, Radikun, Giri Gomerdan,
Thank you.
fighting was there, the friendship was there, Arjuna was there, and Krishna was there, but Arjuna became a different person by devotional service. Therefore, the prayers of Kunti also indicate the same categorical changes in activities. Srimati Kunti wanted to serve the Lord without diversion, and that was her prayer. This unalloyed devotion is the ultimate goal of life. What is the ultimate goal of life? Our attention is usually diverted to the service of something which is non-godly or not in the program of the Lord. When the program is changed into the service of the Lord, that is to say, when the senses are purified in relation with the service of the Lord, it is called pure unalloyed devotional service. Srimati Kunti Devi wanted that perfection and prayed for it from the Lord. Her affection for the Pandavas and the Rishis is not out of the range of devotional service, because the service of the Lord and the service of the devotees are identical. Sometimes service to the devotees is more valuable than service to the Lord. But here, the affection of Kunti Devi for the Pandavas and the Rishis was due to family relation. This high affection in terms of material relation is the relation of Maya. Because the relations of the body or the mind are due to the influence of the external energy. Relations of the soul established in relation with the Supreme Soul are factual relations. When Kunti Devi wanted to cut off the family relation, she meant to cut off the relation of the skin. The skin relation is the cause of material bondage, but the relation of the soul is the cause of freedom. This relation of the soul to the soul can be established by the via media of the relation with the super soul. Seeing in the darkness is not seeing, but seeing by the light of the sun means to see the sun and everything else which was unseen in the darkness. This is the way of devotional service.
Sorry.
Tigris forever flows to the sea without hindrance. Let my attraction be constantly drawn unto you without being perverted to anyone else. We're having an ongoing series about Hasta Ashram, that is serving Srila Prabhupada's mission to the Hasta Ashram. And Shyamalini and Rana Mohan gave me a few topics to speak on today. Striking the balance on your way to Krishna. That's the balance between the material and the spiritual. I picked today's verse because in this prayer to Lord Krishna, Kunti Devi is asking that her mind be drawn to Krishna naturally, the way the Ganges is drawn to the sea. You can't stop the Ganges going to the sea, even if you dam it up. Our friend Aja, who works in Northern California, is a civil engineer, and he is in charge of 8 large dams. Yes? And it's a constant endeavor to keep the water from breaking loose from those dams. You have to let a little bit out. And over years, they need constant repairs. And oftentimes the dams break. And over long enough time, they'll all break. And the water will flow down naturally to the sea. So in the same way, bhakti is a hyperkeep and apratiyata. Ultimately, it can't be checked by any material condition. However, we are within a material condition already, and therefore the Sri Shukranachari says, Vidyam cha vidyam cha yasaka vedo vayam saha, avidyayam ratum tirka, avidyayam ratum ashante. Only one who can learn the process of nations and that of transcendental knowledge. Side by the balance. We're seeking balance. It's the jiggle factor. We talked about it yesterday. Everything needs to be jiggled before it works. The verse I'm quoting is that only one who can learn the process of nations and that of transcendental knowledge side by side can transcend the influence of the good or the death and enjoy the full blessings of immortality. In the explanation of this verse, Srila Prabhupada points out that we don't need to culture nations. It's been done already. It's already the culture in the material world. It's the default mode. Therefore, the Vedas say, I've been born into ignorance. It's my inheritance. And now I'm trying to come out of it. Kamasi ma jyotir mama, the Vedas say, come towards the light, don't stay in darkness. And encourage us to make a culture to come out step by step, gradually. The Srimad Bhagavatam says, Partiva Paro Dumas Kasna Bhaktis Prayimaya. That there's the raw wood, then there's smoke, and then there's fire. And the raw wood is compared to the mode of ignorance. Smoke is the mode of passion. And fire is the mode of goodness. Smoke disturbs, but it doesn't serve. It looks like something's happening, or something's about to happen, but it just disturbs. And the mode of goodness, sattvam yet prama darshanam, means that I can have some darshan of prama. I can see the truth, I can see the difference between matter and spirit from that vantage point. And therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam, in fact, all of the Vedas are a huge project because they're meant to engage everyone, ultimately all living beings, in gradually elevating themselves out of the modes of ignorance, through the mode of passion, to the mode of goodness, and then to the transcendental mode, which is Shuddha Sattva. the unalloyed motive goodness. And so balance in the grahastha life means that I already have material responsibilities. They come along with my birth. And especially upon accepting the grahastha ashram. I was a brahmachari for 13 years. And I remember when I got engaged in Nirgula, and then I realized I had to get an apartment. And I joined the movement when I was 16, so I never had an apartment. I never had a phone, and I didn't have a car. I never had anything. I didn't have a job. And as far as the rest of the world is concerned, the credit world, that is, I didn't exist. So I got an apartment. It was $800. And I signed the lease, and I remember driving home thinking, where am I going to get $800? That was just the beginning. I'd never heard of renter's insurance before. Insurance. So the Srimad Bhagavatam says that along with our birth, we have many kinds of debts to pay. It's natural. The debts are there. And that's coming from the momentum of our previous life. And they're substantial. In fact, Krishna recommends Sarva Dharman Parityaja Mame Kam Sharanam Vraja Aham Tam Sarva Papi Pyo Moksha Ishami Vasacha. What happens, at least in America, when you get in too much debt, you can't pay all your creditors. What do you do? Do you know? You declare bankruptcy. You go before the judge and you say, you know, I don't know how this got out of hand, but it's out of hand. And I can't get it back into perspective, so I need protection from the court, from all my creditors. And so Krishna says, you better come to me, because you're not going to be able to handle all this debt. Therefore he says, surrender to me. So he surrendered to the court. Get a good lawyer to come before the court. Prabhupada once said, spiritual master is like a good lawyer. Knows all the loopholes. And also, a good lawyer knows the law. And a great lawyer knows the judge. The rule of thumb. So, balancing means that, not that we have to figure out how to exactly cultivate more debt, or that we have to practice being in ignorance, or that we have to practice material life. In fact, most of that is natural. There are natural tendencies and proclivities that come along with the body. The Srimad Bhagavatam says that naturally, in this world, everyone has proclivity towards sinful activity like meat eating, illicit sex, gambling, and intoxication. And therefore, the Vedas have given vivaha jagna. The vivaha jagna means the sacrifice of marriage. And it means coming together for us to make it sacred and to regulate it so that one can tame whatever proclivities are there from the material side. So there's Nivritti Marg and Privritti Marg, which are mentioned in the Vedas. One side means, Nivritti Marg means the path of negation or renunciation, and Privritti Marg means the path of enjoyment, material enjoyment. And to balance these two, because the grahastha ashram means we'll have responsibilities, and obviously the propensity is there anyway, so one has to learn how to regulate, balance, and make advancement at the same time. So that is quite a balancing act, isn't it? You do all that? Or is it just me? So there are examples in Shastra of devotees to encourage us. to see that we can live in Krishna consciousness and at the same time perform our material duties, raise a family, live in a house, be responsible, and everything else that goes along with Grihastha Ashram. One notable story is the story of Priyavrata. In the fifth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, at the very beginning, Priyavrata is a great renunciate. He was actually a prince, but Narada Muni was his spiritual master. And Narada Muni tends to preach very heavily on that Nivritti Marg side, that is the side of renunciation, because there's two opinions. And I'll get back to Priyavrata in a second, but first I'll tell you about how Narada Muni approached the sons of Daksha. Daksha was one of the progenitors, or the early great souls in the beginning of the universe, sons of Brahma, who helped to populate the universe. And that was his job. So he had 10,000 sons. And he sent them off for some training to get ready for Grihastha life so that they could have a lot of children and a successful Grihastha ashram. And while they were away at school, Narada Muni met them. And he sat them all down. And they were very intelligent. They were called the Haryashras, 10,000 of them. And he gave them classes every day about renouncing the world. And because they were very intelligent, they listened to him, and they decided to take the path of Nivritti Marg and to give up this idea of following their father's footsteps. So they ran away and they renounced the world. And when Daksha found out, he was furious because he had a plan for them. And he was really annoyed with Narada Muni, but he decided to try again. So this time he had 1,000 sons. And again, he set them off for training, how to become responsible for Grihasthas. And again, Narada Muni came, and he intercepted them. And he told them that this is a temporary world. Why would you try so hard to maintain something you're going to have to give up anyway? And they were also very intelligent, so they renounced everything and they got away. And now Daksha was more than just annoyed, he was furious with Narada Muni. In fact, he cursed him. And Narada Muni, in his conversation with Daksha, told him that this material, actually Daksha, in his anger against Narada Muni, told Narada that unless everyone has the chance to experience material life, then how would they be able to renounce it? And Narada Muni said, that's nonsense. He said, people experience it all the time, they suffer from it, and then they go back and they do it over again. They just forget. He gave the example, sometimes a woman will have a child and the burden of carrying a child and the pain of childbirth and so on, she may say, I'll never do this again. And then another child, seven children later, it goes on. So we tend to take the material enjoyment, suffer, and then decide to renounce and then forget that we're going to renounce and go back again. So Narada Muni said, just take the path of renunciation. So these were the two arguments. And again, when there was the prince, Priyavrata, the son of Swayambhuva Manu, and he was ready to renounce the world because he had the association of Narada Muni. But Swayambhuva Manu needed him to become a temple president and take up responsibility. And he wasn't inclined to do so until Brahma himself came down, his grandfather, and convinced him. And he told him, don't worry. This part made me very encouraging. He said, don't worry. As you're engaged in devotional service, even amidst your household life, you won't fall victim to the material nature. You'll be protected. And that was the case. Although it appeared that Priyavrata became an attached person, because of his contribution to devotional service, and because it was an authorized service that he was doing, he was taking the Grahastha ashram for a purpose. That is, but as service, ultimately he was not affected. So the art of the Grahastha ashram is to follow in the footsteps of the great personalities like Priyavrata and perform our duties well, or as perfectly as possible in the Grahastha ashram. And as I said before, it's an ashram in which we are meant to help and nourish others. It's the only ashram in which actually the devotees are gainfully employed, so to speak, and are making money. And therefore, that's an opportunity to support the other ashrams, those who don't work, and who only concentrate their attention on preaching Krishna consciousness. So balance is required. And this morning I was talking to my very dear friend Keshav Bhardwaj Maharaj, and I just mentioned to him the topic of balance. And he said, well, if you catch that animal and put him in a cage, I'll come and have darshan. And I thought about, that's very interesting, balance. What does it mean to balance? Because often when we're trying to balance, if you stand on or kneel on a ball, a rubber ball, a big rubber ball, you'll find yourself jostling from side to side trying to find your balance. And in the process of finding balance, we go back and forth. The body's always trying to find balance. This homeostasis within the body where we maintain approximately 98.6 temperature. You can feel right now, if it's too warm, then you begin to perspire. That's so that the body has its own cooling system. It will cool you down, and you'll come back down to that level. So there's always, and if you get cold, then the pores close up, and the body's trying to retain heat so you can come to this level, protect all the vital organs, stay at this level of 98.6. So balance means that we are always adjusting. If you go from here, Toronto, to San Francisco on an airplane, it's not an absolute straight line. That's why steering is necessary, because you're going back and forth, back to the center, back to the center. So that's kind of that philosophical side that I'm talking about, balance in the Grahastha ashram. And I want to read something, a letter I wrote to somebody who asked me about affection, because I was thinking about what it means to balance in the Grahastha ashram, seeking the balance, striking the balance between material and spiritual. And there's two main categories that I think are really important. And if there are more, you can tell me what you're thinking. But one is affection. And the verse I just brought up, Queen Kunti is in a conundrum because she has a family, actually they're devotees, but at the same time, she's thinking she doesn't want to be attached to her family on the basis of bodily relations. She wants to be attached to Krishna and Krishna's devotees. But at the same time, when you have a family, you can't just be cold and neglectful. And as Prabhupada says in the purport, that's not a part of devotional life or any kind of life. It's naturally there's affection and there's emotion. I think, in fact, I know early in the Krishna consciousness movement, devotees had an idea that renunciation meant that you had to be withdrawn from emotion and not caring for others. If, for instance, somebody in the family died, somebody else's family, or in one's own family, someone died, and we refer to Bhagavad Gita that
otherwise neither for the living or the dead.
Oh, no big deal.
But there is a big deal, actually. We have these two sides, material and the spiritual side, and they have to be accommodated. Otherwise, artificially, if we try to neglect one or the other, then we'll be out of balance. So, one side is emotion, how we're dealing with people emotionally. Where is our affection going? That's one side. Because obviously, the affection that I have for my body and those things which are in relation to my body are illusory, and they're temporary. But at the same time, we do have association with family members, and they may also be devotees, or they may not yet be what we consider engaged in devotional practice, but still we have a relationship with them. So that's one side, how to balance that. Another side is money. How to live in the world and have responsibilities for income and livelihood without getting swept away or without getting bogged down. What do you think of those two categories as topics for balance in the last talk? On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being fantastic and 1 being that you're ready to leave right now because you're so horrible. 2? I said 1. Oh, you left. So it must have been a 1. How was everybody, by the way?
Great.
I can't remember what's in this letter, but I thought it struck me as a good idea to read it, so let's see what happens. May I have permission?
Yes.
First, I'll read the question. The question was, I've read and heard taught the concept of becoming detached from people, including one's family, and even Krishna's devotees. I'm having some difficulty understanding how these seemingly different concepts, affection and detachment, are cohesive. My question is, sir, how do these two concepts coexist? And here's what I wrote. Dear such and such, Hare Krishna, thank you for your excellent question. Affection for Krishna, his devotees, and for all living things can coexist with detachment from people, including one, excuse me. Affection for Krishna, his devotees, and for all things can coexist with detachment from people, including one's family and from the world. The devotee's detachment is based on knowledge of everyone's and everything's relationship with Krishna. For example, if I see someone drop a $100 bill from his pocket, I do not become attached to it, knowing to whom it belongs. I can happily pick it up and give it back. Knowing that all things come from God and belong to Him, a devotee engenders a natural sense of detachment and works peacefully, giving his energy to God. Devotees who are detached in knowledge know how to relate to all people and things in the world without becoming enamored of them, thinking these are mine. No, the devotee knows that everything comes from Krishna, and therefore he loves and honors everyone and everything as Krishna's. In this way, as the Bible mentioned, the person I was speaking to is Krishna. As the Bible mentions, one may, quote, live in the world, but not the other. And in the Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna that a transcendentalist lives in the world like the lotus that grows in the water but is never touched by it. Such a devotee is not cold or artificially detached. On the contrary, the devotee who has awakened this acute sense of God's presence in all things actually feels more deeply for all living beings. Her feelings of connectedness are in relationship to Krishna, and therefore they are eternal and vital. Attachment to others based merely on a bodily relation is, by comparison, superficial and ephemeral. In Gita, Krishna states, he is a perfect yogi who, by comparison to his own self, sees the true equality of all beings in both their happiness and their distress, O Arjuna. Of course, one has a natural attachment from one's own family. But in the ultimate issue, when a devotee sees his or her parents, children, or other relations or friends dying, for example, although she feels the pain of separation, she also understands that they are in God's care and that the soul is moving on. In this way, she is detached. Again, however, the devotee's sense of detachment is not impersonal or unfeeling. Even though detached, the devotee feels a profound connection to all souls. In fact, the emotions that a devotee feels while experiencing the losses and gains that come in this world actually enhance his tendency to love God. He sees and experiences these emotions and realizes where they come from. The spiritual world, wherein all souls live in the flow of emotional love for God and for one another. An advanced devotee is also practical. Knowing that she must work to maintain the body and soul together, a spiritually balanced woman who goes to a job interview would not, when asked where she's from, tell the interviewer, "Oh, I'm from the spiritual world." No, to get the job, she must say, "I'm from Dallas, Texas," or wherever she's from. Her job may not be entirely spiritual either. However, because she needs it to maintain herself and her family, it's her duty to perform it well. And at the same time, because she's maintaining her family, knowing that ultimately they're God's children, she works happily to maintain them. A devotee eats to live rather than living to eat. And then there's some closing words. So I was thinking about the side of detachment and how the devotee is detached. And it's not in an artificial way, but actually it's an enhanced way, because we actually see the reality of where the emotions are coming from. And therefore, there's much in Vaishnava writings about how to transfer our emotions towards Krishna, as this verse is saying. And that takes place in the context of family, of husband and wife, of children, all those things. It's not separate from that. In other words, it's all possible while being within the context of a so-called material life. And that's what the verse, Vidyam Cha, Vidyam Cha Yas, means. It means that while you're living in this life, you learn from it, actually. You learn that the emotions are natural. And then you see how those are actually coming from the spiritual world, from Krishna. And you can experience that. So, therefore, Rupa Goswami gives, for example, a verse, Yuvatina Vita Yuni, Yunam Chai Yuvata Yuta, Mano Viravate Kadvam, Mano Meiramatam Tvayi. He says, "O Krishna, let my mind be drawn to you the same way that a young girl is attached to a young boy, and the young boy is naturally attached to a young girl, without trying. You don't train them up. They just look out the window and they're gone. That's the way it is. It's a natural attraction that takes place." And there are many verses like this. In fact, Rupa Goswami, it says in another place, that the same way as a lover is waiting for a letter from his beloved. You know how if you're waiting for a love letter in the mail every day, you might check the mail over and over again. Or if it's email, you might check it 10 times an hour to see, did the letter come, right? Isn't this a natural kind of proclivity? If someone's anticipating something like that. So he was saying, so when that letter comes and then the beloved reads aloud that letter, there's no other consideration of anything else in the world. That, you know, something can be cooking on the stove, it can burn, or whatever. This is full absorption, and reads it aloud with so much gusto. He said, let me have that same emotion for reading the Srimad Bhagavatam. my mind, that kind of emotion to be absorbed, just like that. So the emotion is there, everything is there, and we experience it actually in the Grihastha Ashram, but at the same time, because we have the process of Krishna consciousness, we learn how to transfer those emotions to Krishna, and we see actually where they're coming from. I always wondered about how I would experience my parents leaving the world, because I was very attached to them. Even as a brahmachari, and when I joined the movement, of course, there's the experience when you take up anything for the first time, and when you're a beginner, you tend to overemphasize. Like, as soon as I discovered the semicolon when I started to write, I used semicolons everywhere. And my teacher said, no, you don't need a semicolon everywhere, you just need it every once in a while. So any kind of new discipline or thing that we take up, we can overemphasize it. And of course, the Brahmacharya Ashram, when I took that Brahmacharya Ashram, then immediately, I just walked away from my parents, and then I moved far away from in San Francisco, where they lived. We kept in touch, but I still kept myself a little bit isolated physically, thinking that I would be affected. And it might happen. But later on, when I came back and had more association with my family and my parents, I realized how attached I was to my mother and my father. And I used to ask devotees what it was like when their parents left the world, because I was wondering how I would react to it. And it was a life-changing experience, because I saw that the kind of emotion that came, first my father passed away, then my mother, but I remember such a heavy heart I had when my father passed away. And there was no avoiding it, it was just natural. It happened in such a natural way. And the devotees actually, I was blessed to be around at the time, I was in Vrindavan. They were very emotionally supportive. They didn't say, oh, he's not his body, and don't worry about it. I would have been, actually at that time, I would have been injured emotionally, psychologically, if devotees had treated me like that. In fact, I still remember the devotees around the MPT in Vrindavan, who, when they heard my father had passed away, came and embraced me and, showed some affection and support. And I remember how important that was. My point is that there are natural emotions that we have, and attachments to wife, children, family, everything. And part of balance is to cultivate an understanding of where that comes from, and not artificially renounce it, and also not become swept away by it on the material side. But balance means understanding how to experience it and enhance my understanding of what is the nature of the spiritual world, and how these emotions actually exist there, and how this world is only a reflection of the spiritual world. Am I okay so far? Are you sure?
Yes.
Should I stop right now and just take questions? Is it too philosophical? Keep going. Okay, I'll go a little bit further. Then, on the other side, Grihastha Ashram balance means that you have to make money. At least we do, anyway. In order to maintain yourself. And also, I've thought many times, sometimes someone takes the Grihastha Ashram and then may be out of balance and think that I'll also be a renunciate. Of course, there are cases of Grihasthas who are great renunciates, but at the same time, that's different from being irresponsible. And not taking up the responsibilities of actually having a successful quote-unquote material life. And what happens is, usually those kinds of people become dependent on others. But that's not the duty of the Grihastha Ashram. The duty of the Grihastha Ashram is to take on dependence. So you must be responsible. You have to learn how to take care of yourself so that you can take care of others. Does that make sense? Grihasthas, before they eat, go out onto the porch and call out in all the directions, if anybody's hungry, please come and eat. They take care of people. They take care of brahmacharis and sannyasis and vanaprasthas who are just full on preaching and don't have any other concern. And this is a good balance in society. So it's actually a kind of renunciation in the Grihastha Ashram to be responsible, very responsible materially, to pay attention to details in your life, to be organized, to set goals. These are not outside the realm of the ashram, because by doing that, you become stable. And you become a stabilizing element in society, and you're able to help others generously, so that they can go on and do all kinds of work. Now, how does it all work that I'm Krishna conscious in the midst of all that? My favorite analogy in that regard is yogurt. And the way you make yogurt is you take a little yogurt culture, if I'm not mistaken. And you can start with a very large pot of milk. And into that milk, you put a little bit of yogurt culture. Am I saying it correctly so far? And where would you put that milk with the yogurt culture? Help me out here. Yeah, you put it in a warm place. It does not too warm, but warm enough so that it's not, so the culture can live. And how long would you leave it? And what happens in the morning? Magic. The whole thing turns to yogurt. One little bit of yogurt culture, one big pot of milk. So our material life is one big pot of milk. And the culture of Krishna consciousness is like that yogurt culture. Even if we add a little bit, it'll expand. In fact, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught Sanatana Goswami that out of the 64 items of devotional service, there are five that are particularly potent and important. And those are hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, the association of devotees, chanting Hare Krishna, worshiping the deity, living in a holy place, and doing sankirtan. So these five, he said, even with a little bit of connection to them, can bring one to the highest level. That's yoga culture. And today, it's a very fast-paced world. Everyone's forced to work very hard. Everywhere I go, it's like this. Some places more than others. In Japan, people work so hard. The devotees that have jobs there, they have to work very, very hard just to maintain a little apartment. And on your day off in Japan, in many companies, they expect you to come in anyway just to show support to the company. How do you like that? You can't do this thing of working from home like you do. I'm not naming any names, but I'm going to work from home today. You have to go in even on your day off to show that you really care about the company. So there and everywhere else, very difficult to maintain that. So while we're doing that, it's vital that we retain connection. Even if it's a little bit, though, this is the encouraging part. Even if it's a small culture, that culture will grow. If it's done with concentration, and if it's done in good association, that will grow and it will transform us. So I've talked about maintaining balance in the Grihastha Ashram, specifically talking about emotional balance and financial. I didn't go into much detail, but I just broached the subject. And I mentioned the idea that everything comes originally from Krishna. All resources are His. Real detachment means to understand where they come from. Then we'll have a natural sense of responsibility and stewardship towards everything that we have, and we want to use it in Krishna's service, no matter how many things we have. And now I would like to ask you for for your reflections or questions. So you can either give a reflection, that is one thing you heard that stuck in your mind, that you either find useful or that you abhor and you'd like to complain about it, or one question that you have. And I'll take, we'll take four only. Questions first. Okay, the time's up. So. Thank you for bringing it up. I'll just clarify when I thought of it, actually, and how I thought of it. And I brought it up in relation to my father passing away. I was in Vrindavan at the time, and mostly every day going to Parikara and hearing and chanting and absorbing the root of Vrindavan and thinking about devotional service. And being in that environment, at the same time getting a phone call that he had passed away, and then feeling this natural heavy heart, I related it to how devotees naturally feel separation from Krishna. And sometimes hearing about these things is very theoretical because I may not fully experience it. I mean, when we hear about devotees fainting when somebody leaves, we may just think, oh, that's interesting. But have you ever fainted when somebody left? You know, you're so attached to them that you think of them. But the intensity of the emotion that comes when, through a material attachment like a father or a mother, you can actually experience what it might feel like. And this is my point, that the crossover is transforming our material attachment into spiritual attachment. That's what the Padyavali is all about. And that's what this verse, Yuvati Nam Yutai Yunir, which I mentioned about how lust is transformed into love. In other words, Rupa Goswami says, just as young boys are attached to young girls attached to young boys, let my mind be like that. So the point is that you experience this, we want to experience. I mean, the soul actually wants emotion. We want stimulation. We want to experience something deeply. However, the problem is there's an anomaly when we experience it in the material sense because it's not fulfilling. There's an inebriety to it, and therefore it's contaminated. But the spiritual emotion is not contaminated. Therefore, separation and those feelings are unbounded happiness at the same time, but they are a kind of suffering. It's, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, separation is like, can only be compared to having poison, the poison of the snake bite and nectar pointed on your head simultaneously. So just to open up the heart anyway, because in the material life really it's steel framed, it's closed. And anything that opens it up actually is something experiential. But when you do it in the context of devotional service and you balance it with understanding, oh, this is what it might feel like when I faint, when Krishna leaves, or when his dear devotee leaves, something like that, then you can actually have an insight. It's a window into what is the emotion of the spiritual world. Shreya, Kanta, Kanta, Parama, Purusha, Kalpataro, Vrima, Vrimish, Chintamani, Dhamani, Toyama, Vrita. There's an expression in the Brahma Samhita about how everyone in the spiritual world is feeling these emotions so much that they're dancing, they can't stop in their movement. It's all active. And it's all coming from an ocean of emotions. So we're looking for that. what is the source of it and trying to relate it back to Krishna. Thank you for your reflection. Okay, we'll only take three more. One, two. You choose.
Go ahead. Okay, I have a chance.
Maharaj, it's easy to misunderstand this this verse that she can't stop the way to the ocean, but on the way to the ocean, she is doing so many other things. She is taking the time to irrigate all the fields who are along her banks. She is taking the time to purify all the devotees who are bathing in her waters. She is taking the time to give her water to be used as abhishek for the various deities who are along the river. She is doing all this stuff while going continuously into the ocean. So I thought that when I first read it, I actually misunderstood this whole verse. Exactly as you said.
That's brilliant. It's really brilliant. Thank you. I really like that. Spiritual master came to him in dreams and beckoned to him to come. And then he went to confirm those by talking to senior godbrothers. And some of them told him conflicting things. Some said, you have to, if you stay in our organization over here for some time and show your allegiance, then maybe you can take sannyas. And others said, and then ultimately his sannyas guru told him, no, you should take right now. And he did. But things don't come in neat packages for everyone. There are many kinds of circumstances and things to be considered. Therefore, we need to consider those things carefully and take guidance as we go forth. And it's not stereotyped. Is that ambiguous enough for you? It's custom made.
I think too that we should always do our best in whatever we're doing, whether it's work, school, raising your children, whatever it is, we're representing Srila Prabhupada and Vaishnavas. Not everyone may know that we're Vaishnava, but somehow or other, you're representing, and I think to just feel good about yourself, you should always do your best. But as my husband's been talking about, balance. You know when you're going a little too far, or you know that. And so it's just about keeping balance. And then too, associating with like-minded devotees who you see of living a life that appears to be in balance to you. If you want to take up the Grihastha Ashram, associate with couples that you see have a nice marriage. It's what you do in Krishna consciousness, whatever you want to do. If you see someone who is knowledgeable in the scripture, or is expert in pujari service or sankirtan, you associate with them and to find out, you know, how they do it so that you are also in that flow of consciousness, like that.
Is that four? Is there one more? Go ahead.
Can we take that one of the two or else let him speak?
Oh, all right.
Thank you so much. I should have kind of a practical question. You were speaking about affection and specifically emotions. We don't hear much about this, so could you please enliven us and enlighten us about what is the role of physical affection in the Grihastha Ashram? What Srila Prabhupada speaks about that, because on one hand we know about regulated principles, that's one aspect, but I mean just like physical affection itself, and just if it's actually so important, or emotional support is something kind of like a replacement, or just what?
Yeah. It's important. It's important because we're living, breathing human beings. There were some really weird studies. Well, there are studies anyway about raising children. I remember in the 1960s, I think Dr. Spock was one of the proponents of, you know, leave children alone, don't touch them. You know, if they're crying, just leave them. I don't know, that's why I said it was weird. It seems weird to me that they would expect any kind of outcome from what they got, and that was that the children became dysfunctional because they weren't touched. And even when babies are born, the ones that get physical contact and they feel their mother, their father, you know, they're being touched and held, emotionally it grows something, they develop something deep inside because of that touch. And in any relationship, that kind of touch is important. You see, in America or in the Western culture, men don't hold hands. In India they do, and it's not considered to be a like a relationship with, you know, it's not a homosexual relationship or something like that. It's just that they have, they show their affection. So they're like, you know, they'll hold hands. Like. You know, they'll walk down the street like that, right, Yor?
Yeah. Bengal, especially.
Bengal, hold hands. And, you know, I have godbrothers all the time that, like, will hold hands or we'll put our arm around the shoulder or something like that. That's really important. And when I was in, when I said when my father passed away, there was one godbrother of mine came up and hugged me, you know, and cured me. I mean, I felt better. And in Grahastha Ashram, I'm also, you know, you're dealing with living, breathing, living entities. They need to be held. They need to be patted. They need to be touched. You know, that sensation, it goes deep to the soul. When it's done out of, you know, kind, loving affection, you know, to show that you really care. And, you know, that's done in it's a non-sexual thing. It's just, you know, it's out of affection. You know, you gotta have a hug sometimes, right? So that it's important, and we're not some dry machines or something like that. So it's vital. Did that help? Or if you want more explication, I'll hand it over to your school.
Is that something that needs to be balanced as well, or
you know, we can depend on Krishna.
Well, depending on Krishna means to use your intelligence also to depend on Krishna. And goal setting is very important. I think, is your specific question, like, what if we, how do we plan for our service in the future? That in case we have to, you know, right now we don't have children or something, and then later on we might have a different situation, so should we plan?
Like, financially also, many times, financial goals, people say that we should plan.
Okay, financial goals. Well, just as an example, financial planning is very important. And I mentioned the scriptural precedent for this from the Chaitanya Charitamrita, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu specifically noted that Vasudeva Dutta, who was a great devotee and a grahastha, wasn't taking any care to save money or do anything responsible for his finances, even though he was an exalted devotee. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told Sridhara the same, he will look after him, be his financial advisor, to make sure that he has some savings. To plan like that is really important, because otherwise, where are you going to live? I mean, this is a very practical side, that you have to have a place to live and you have to have some resources. So planning financially is not out of the realm of your ashram. You have to do that. There's a book I read early on when I became a grahastha called The Richest Man in Babylon. It's a great book. It's about this. Have you read that? It's by somebody Clausen. Is his last name? And it's just about the basic principles of developing some wealth, which start with put away 10% of your income, pay yourself first. It means you pay all your other bills, right? You pay your rent, you pay for your MasterCard or whatever, and you should also have an envelope there where you pay yourself 10%. If you don't earn enough to do that, you should earn more or spend less. But put away 10% before you pay everybody else. And then put that aside in some kind of investment so that you can develop something to support others. And in times of emergency and times of things that you want to develop. This is just an example, like one specific example of planning. Very important. Take the time to learn skills. There are people who are expert in planning and goal setting, things like that, where you can take help, you can learn how to do certain kinds of things, and then apply them in your ashram and use them for Krishna.
Sometimes you might get you know, at the end of the year, at least, you know, after Christmas and everything, it's usually, you know, you've done a marathon, you've been through the whole year, it's dark and cold and wet outside. You know, you might be a little in the doldrums, but then you look back and you see, wow, we did this past year, we got this done. You know, it's very enlightening, and then you can, you know, you have the year goals, the 5-year goals, and it's very empowering. In your devotional service. So I don't know if that helps at all, you know, too, with what you're saying.
So wonderful. Thank you so much.
Gouda.
I know I'm exceeding the 4-question limit, but
no, this is
I just have one sentence to say, and it's in regard to
hold the mic right like this.
I just have one sentence to make, and it's in regard to value of these points about expression of affection. I remember reading somewhere from Srila Prabhupada where he stated that because he received so much affection in his youth from his loving mother and his loving father and also from his Guru Maharaj, therefore he is able to give so much today. And that statement really stood out in my mind. It's important at a certain point in our life, ideally early in our life, to be a taker, to be a receiver. Because the more we can take and receive, and the more we can dish it out. And Srila Prabhupada is the greatest example of that.
That's really a nice point. Thank you. Yeah, that's three. Anything else? Yes. Or earlier.
Because then you have to look at yourself and say, like, what am I holding back? why aren't I actually saying the whole thing, you know, giving full disclosure or revelation or something like that? And then, you know, and you can also tell, this is part of in the grasp of ashram, when you live with somebody else this closely, and you can tell if they're holding something back. And you can sort of coach it out of them, like, I know you're not telling me everything. Come on, you know, tell it. So that keeps things fresh. Because, you know, freshness really is, it's a realization of, it's an inner realization. It's not something that, you know, you have to redecorate the house every 5 minutes. Although I did read a Reader's Digest once, and I was standing in line, or it was on the cover or something, so it just said if you rearrange the furniture in your house, it can dramatically change your relationship. So you might want to try that. Thank you for inviting us into your hearts. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.